Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
It seems like a lot of books begin with a basic question. For the science writer David Baron, his latest began with this one. Where did we get this fascination with Mars? We have been obsessed with the red planet for a long time. Back when humans didn't have a clue about Mars, there were these theories and ideas. But even now, people are drawing up plans for Mars settlements, a kind of plan B in case the home planet gets too crowded or burns up. In his book, Baron homes in on a period around the turn of the last century where there was what he calls this Mars craze that was spreading like an epidemic.
ABC News presents the flight of Apollo 11, beginning 30 hours of continuous coverage of the lunar landing.
I was born in the 1960s, the time of the Apollo space program.
Man is about to land on the moon.
And I was raised on excitement about outer space. And also about Martians.
I claim this planet in the name of Mars.
There was Marvin the Martian, intent on destroying the Earth.
Where the cotton-picking heck am I?
You are on Mars. Isn't that lovely?
There seemed to be Martians everywhere in popular culture back then.
Damn, I got a surprise for dinner. The one earthly delicacy I'll miss when I get back to Mars. Hot corned beef.
There was a popular sitcom called My Favorite Martian back then that my family used to watch.
Oh, Tim.
What?
Where were you?
Oh, I was doing a little research.
There were Martians in comic books, Martians in science fiction. They were just everywhere. And, you know, I grew up into a science journalist and author. And I started to wonder about my childhood and where all that excitement about Mars came from. Because it continues today. Maybe not Martians quite as much, but Mars, more than any other celestial body, it seems, just really captures the public's imagination. Where did that all start? And so I decided to look into the history of it. And I knew that back around the turn of the last century, there was a lot of excitement about Mars and the possibility of civilization there. I knew about that. But I then started to do my own research, and I looked in old newspapers. And as soon as I went into these old newspaper archives, which of course is very easy today, I was just floored because about 60 years before I was born, Martians were not staples in science fiction, they were widely believed to be scientific fact. I mean, I was finding these astonishing newspaper articles from the New York Herald, the New York Times, saying, in all seriousness, there is life on the planet Mars. The Wall Street Journal, in 1907, at the very end of the year, said the biggest news of 1907 was proof of intelligent life on Mars. And these articles, these full-page articles, would go on about the proof that there's a civilization on Mars, questions about what the Martians might be like, speculation on being able to communicate with them. And I needed to figure out where that all came from, because it's that period that has rippled down to today and left us with this sense that Mars is special. Mars is different. In the end, I found that it really was a story about humans as much as, if not more so, than Martians. It really ended up being a story about why we believe what we believe, how ideas spread, and the ways in which science is influenced by psychology. We tend to think of science as an objective investigation, but it's impossible to separate science from the subjective ideas of the investigators. So it became a very, very rich tale. And it ended up being really quite poignant and serious, what I discovered, the lessons that I uncovered.
The This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, David Barron is with us to take us through his story about the time we Earthlings fell hard for another planet, which meant projecting our hopes and our fantasies onto another place. The book is called The Martians.
As a kid myself, when I was in high school, Carl Sagan's PBS series, The Cosmos, was on TV. Yeah. And I, like millions of others, it was must-watch television.
Yeah.
He talked about this period when America went Mars crazy, and he talked about an astronomer named Percival Lowell, who was a wealthy Bostonian, highly educated, but not a professional astronomer, who decided late in life to become an astronomer and use some of his wealth to establish an observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is still there, the Lowell Observatory.
Yeah.
And Percival Lowell took it upon himself to become the world's expert on Mars. And it was Lowell who, more than anyone, promulgated this idea that Mars was covered by canals. And if there are canals, well, then there must be canal diggers, the Martians. That was about all I remembered from watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos series. So I figured, you know, what I was reading in the newspapers about this belief in life on Mars, it must have, and in fact it did, largely come from Percival Lowell. I had no idea the extent to which the idea had been accepted.
So you wrote a book in 2017 about the story of this total solar eclipse in 1878. And it seems to have a similar kind of theme in this new book. That is, there's a history of astronomy, which you write about in that book, and then you get to you process it through a particular moment in history. Is that what you're getting at here? And I wonder if, because this is certainly it's about the history of astronomy to some degree, but it's also just history. It's about not a biography necessarily, but I wonder if that has surprised you, that it's maybe less about the explication of science as these interesting characters who are processing these ideas about science. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, so I've been a science writer for, 40 years. Much of my early career, I worked for NPR, and I worked for various public radio stations and other outlets. And my goal all along, back when I worked in public radio and now writing books, was to tell science stories in a way that I hope to hook people who think they have no interest in science. Because science, like any human endeavor, is a human endeavor. These are stories of people. And I think everyone is interested in just a good story of fascinating characters at a fascinating time, with a plot that goes in interesting directions and leaves you at a different place at the end than where you began. And that's when I was in radio and now writing books. That's my goal, is to just tell a really good human story that happens to do with science, so people might learn about science along the way. My book, American Eclipse, as you say, which came out in 2017, the true story of a total solar eclipse that crossed America's Wild West and helped inspire America's rise as a scientific power, was ultimately just a fascinating story of the Wild West, of these Eastern scientists, including Thomas Edison, who came to Wyoming for the eclipse, an all-female expedition from Vassar that came west. I loved it as a story. Just as a sidebar, I might say it's being turned into a Broadway musical, if you can believe it.
Wow.
It's hopefully going to have its premiere at a regional theater sometime in 2027, and the producers want to get to Broadway in 2028.
Wow.
They just saw it as a great story of history and people. And again, that's really what I'm going for. And that's what I was going for in The Martians as well. It's a story about Martians and about astronomy, but it's really about America at that time, about the news media, how ideas spread. It's connected in various ways to what the Wright brothers were doing, to the Spanish-American War, to the building of the Panama Canal, to the race to be the first at the North Pole. All of these things come up in the book, and they're all interconnected. So you can't just take astronomy out from the rest of culture. It's all, particularly something like The Martians, where it really did infiltrate the culture. It's all tied together. Mm. And the reasons why that people believed in The Martians was says a lot about what the people at that time were thinking and striving for and why they wanted to believe in the Martians, because that's an important part of the
tale. Yeah, which we'll get to. Before we jump into the characters and the stories and the particular moments of history, I want to set up what seems to be kind of an interesting, I don't know, tension in the book. And this is something you set out early on in the book. You say that you can interpret this story as either a cautionary tale of mass delusion, or you can see it as, you know, this really kind of inspiring story about imagination and inventiveness. Would you say a little bit more about how those, you know, two kind of conflicting ideas seem to be something that interests you in the book?
Well, I knew from the start that this was a story about a really big failure in science.
Yeah.
And so that's where I started. I thought, well, this is a story about how we can kid ourselves into believing things that aren't true because we wish they were true, whether it that applies to Percival Lowell or to the New York Times and the readers of the New York Times. But the more I got into it, putting myself in the mindset of someone in the late 1890s or early 1900s, reading about what Percival Lowell was seeing, there were these strange things being seen on Mars. The idea that there was an intelligent civilization there that was building irrigation canals was certainly, I think, a theory worth investigating. So I didn't laugh at it quite as much when I realized what people knew at the time. They didn't have the pictures being sent back by the Curiosity and Perseverance rovers. They couldn't see what Mars really looked like.
So as you have said, the book is centered on a man named Percival Lowell, whom you gave us a sense of who he was. Let's talk a little bit more about who he was. It's an interesting way of putting it in the book. You said as you delved into his background, you came to appreciate, this is how you put it, the prison he inhabited. So he's handsome, he's rich, also eccentric. He has this kind of sensitive disposition, possibly bipolar, makes some mistakes when he's young, but he sort of matures. Like, what's the prison that he inhabited? What do you mean?
So Percival Lowell was a Boston Brahmin, and the Brahmins were the elite caste of New England who had much of the money, were looked up to as erudite, and they were philanthropists. They were kind of the ruling class in Boston. So to be born into that, and he was the firstborn son, the expectation was that he would take over his father's business. The Lowells made their fortune in textiles in the early 1800s. At the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the city of Lowell, Massachusetts is named for them.
Yeah.
So Percival Lowell, by the time he came along, his family was extraordinarily rich. They were very much involved in the running of Harvard University. They were involved in the founding of MIT. But Percival Lowell, you know, he wanted to, he did have this sort of artistic side to him. He was bored working in his grandfather's office, just investing the family money. He wanted to do more. The first thing he did for the first half of his adulthood was he traveled extensively. He spent a lot of time, particularly in Asia, in Japan and in Korea, at a time when East Asia was this whole very mysterious region for Americans. And Lowell, who graduated from Harvard in 1876 and was a good writer, became a professional writer. He wrote for magazines. He wrote books about Asian cultures. But he always had this interest in science. He studied some science when he was an undergraduate at Harvard. And as he approached the age of 40, and you get a sense he was kind of restless, he was looking for something new to do. And to be a Lowell meant you needed to do it big. You needed to do something important that people would really look up to. And he read a book by a French astronomer named Camille Flammarion about Mars. And Flammarion talked about the canals on Mars that had been discovered by an Italian astronomer. And this is true. In 1877, Giovanni Schiaparelli, who noticed this network of fine straight lines on Mars, so straight they seemed artificial, but he didn't know what they were. He figured, though, that they were waterways of some sort. And he called them canali, which in Italian means channels. And he was not saying necessarily that they were canals that they were dug by someone. They were channels like the English Channel, a narrow waterway, could be perfectly natural. But that term was mistranslated into canals in English. And so as early as 1877, you had people in the English-speaking world joking about these canals on Mars. Flammarion very much believed that there was an intelligent civilization on Mars, and that just lit the fire for Percival Lowell that he was going to dedicate the next stage of his career to studying the Martians. And it was a natural, it seems crazy, but it was a natural extension of what he was doing in Asia. He was studying alien cultures on Earth, and now he was going to extend that to the planet next door.
David Baron. His book is The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. Harmon'sGrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the science writer David Baron. His new book is about our obsession with Mars and the science that's fueled that fascination. Baron writes about a time when astronomers were convinced there was proof. There was life on the red planet, actual intelligent beings who had built a civilization that included irrigation canals for Martians who tended crops. Now, eventually, it all gave way to actual science, but Baron says it shows how we tend to project our hopes for this planet onto other ones. The book is called The Martians. I want to come back to this idea of these canals, these formations or stripes that people see or say they see on the surface of Mars through a telescope. Come back to this Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, and talk about this moment. You write about a particular moment. This is in August of 1877. He's 42 years old. He's respected. He's well known. And he climbs the stairs of this observatory to see this total eclipse of the moon. But he's interested in Mars. So just talk about this moment and what it is that he sees.
So Schiaparelli, he was just drawn to Mars that night. And so he wanted to look at the surface closely and to figure out, in fact, if he could make the most detailed map yet of Mars. And what he saw first was Mars has very obvious dark areas and light areas, which he assumed were oceans and continents. And Mars looked very Earth-like in the broadest sense, in that it's seemed to have oceans and continents. And he was the one who saw that besides these supposed oceans and continents, there were these straight lines that he called canali, waterways. And so he, in 1877, made his first map, which was kind of mysterious. 2 years later, he updated his map. And now the lines got even straighter. They were really mysterious because they were so straight, it was hard to imagine that they were natural.
Right.
And he discovered something which was, on occasion, some of the lines overnight would double. So one night you'd see just a straight line. The next night you look at the same place. Now there are two parallel lines in that same spot.
Yeah.
Really weird. And these canals would come and go with the seasons. So they weren't always there. They would fade. They would come into, then they would come back. He was totally perplexed about what these could be.
It's interesting that the way scientists of the time respond to the idea of these being, you know, not natural. There's a scientist, Edward Holden. He's pretty dismissive. And one of the things he says is, what we should say in response to what this is, because people are asking, well, what is it? And he said, the answer is, I don't know. But then the French philosopher you mentioned, Camille Flammarion,
Flammarion, yeah.
Yeah. Camille Flammarion, he's not having it. He thinks scientists should explain. You say he believed that it was a scientist's job to creatively explain the unexplained. Will you say a little bit more? Because this, again, gets at that tension between imagination and being creative and just also being a pure scientist who says, I don't know, let's not speculate.
Right. Well, so this was in the early 1890s. Edward Holden was the director of the Lick Observatory in California, which had the largest telescope on Earth at the time. What the Lick Observatory astronomers had to say was taken very seriously. But here, these ideas were swirling about a possible civilization on Mars. And astronomers were reporting these strange lights on Mars that the public was getting all excited might be signals that the Martians were sending our way. And Edward Holden, the head of the Lick Observatory, said, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know what the lights are. We don't know what the lines are on Mars. And we should admit that. Camille Flammarion did say in response that was just giving up.
Yeah.
That a scientist's job is to start with what you don't know and then try to imagine what could be, try to come up with an explanation. And that is a tension that exists even today between more conservative scientists who like to stick with the data and just say, well, that's all I know. You know, we can't go beyond the data. And then others who are more willing to use their imagination, and these tend to be the science popularizers too, who say, well, we don't know, but then what could it be?
Yeah.
You know, could it be that there's a civilization on Mars that is digging these so-called canals, that is flashing lights our way? And often it's that imagination that will push scientists and others to investigate, well, okay, is this hypothesis true or not? And it's the imagination that often does get the public excited. Hmm. And some scientists see that as a bad thing. You're getting the public all excited about things that may not be true. And others see it as quite a positive thing. If the public gets excited about science, about things that, you know, are legitimate areas of exploration, how bad is that? In fact, it's a good thing.
So Percival Lowell, he's on Team Flammarion more than he is on Team Holden, it
Absolutely.
Seems, right? Let's talk about what he thinks is going on, because he develops his own rather intricate theory for what is happening up there with those canals. He thinks what's happening is Mars is in distress. It's a drying out planet, I guess.
Right. So I'll try to keep this simple, but it's quite a complex theory.
Yeah.
So first of all, Mars was believed to be an older planet than Earth in its evolution. And by that, I mean all the planets, it was believed and is believed, formed out of a swirling mass of gas and dust at the very formation of the solar system. And they started as these molten globules that slowly cooled and hardened. And Mars, which is quite a bit smaller than Earth, being a smaller body, would have lost its heat more quickly and become had a solid surface before Earth. Presumably became habitable before Earth, if it did become habitable. And that would mean that life could have formed there before Earth. Life might have evolved to intelligence there before Earth. So if you, again, this is taking a small idea and extrapolating quite far, but it was not crazy to think, well, if life evolved on Mars, it may be further down some path of evolution than it is on Earth. Secondly, now here, Lowell made the claim, which some people believed, but was kind of, even when he made it, was losing its credibility among scientists, but he claimed that as a planet ages, it loses its water, that the water will naturally seep down into the Earth or get absorbed by minerals and that sort of thing. And he claimed that because Mars is older than Earth, it has already lost most of its water. And he claimed that even the dark areas that were seen on Mars by Schiaparelli and were called oceans were not oceans. They were just areas of either dark rock, or maybe slightly marshy areas that had some vegetation. But really, Mars, he said, was a desert planet. And that fit with this idea that Mars had lost most of its water, as planets do. Mm-hmm. Mars does have ice caps. You can see them through a telescope from Earth. So the North and South Pole have these white caps that grow in the winter and fade in the spring and summer. Okay, he assumed that that must be water. We actually know today it's mostly carbon dioxide, dry ice. But he assumed, well, there's water on Mars. It melts in the spring. Where does it go? It's got to go somewhere. There are these lines that Schiaparelli saw. Lowell saw even more of them, these straight lines crisscrossing the planet. They tended to appear in the spring and summer and fade the fall and winter. So what he said was, well, what we're seeing is a global irrigation network. This is what the Martians are using to tap the meltwater from the poles and bring it down to their desert farms and their oasis cities. But we're not seeing the water. After all, a canal would have to be miles and miles wide to be seen from Earth. Yeah. No, what you're seeing is the vegetation along these waterways as it greens up in the spring and summer and then fades in the fall and winter. Again, that actually fit with the observations that the canals would come and go through the year. So it was a coherent theory. And
well,
also
to say more about the coherence of the theory, at least then. So people weren't – so it sounds absurd now, of course, given the time period of where we are right now. But as you say, at the time, it was a reasonable sort of hypothesis, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he was making many leaps, but it did, you know, it was consistent with the observations.
Yeah.
Huh. And to a large extent with the theory about how planets form. But if you get to this point where, all right, if Mars has life, if it evolved, if life evolved there before Earth, if civilization appeared on Mars before Earth because it had a head start.
Right.
And now Mars is running out of its water. What would a civilization do facing that water crisis?
Right.
Well, it would have to band together and figure out a way to distribute whatever water is left on the planet so that everyone can survive. So that's what he claimed he was seeing.
It's interesting because it gets to the other part of that idea that they're further along than us, therefore they're more highly evolved. And so this idea of these Martians being advanced in terms of evolution, what's the presumption of then what evolution would do to them? Because what you write about is that people saw them as being more moral than we were, that they were seen as kind of guardian angels, that we had these hopes and expectations that maybe this is where we were headed. Say more about that.
Well, there was this widely held view that at the time that evolution was this progressive process, which really it's not. But that you know, you had it naturally moved from simple to complex, and evolution at that time was being applied to everything, and not just to anatomical beings, but to how societies form and develop, and you know, the evolutionary idea of human societies was that they progressed from savage to barbarian to civilized.
Yeah.
Well, evolution is a process; it continues. So, if we have reached the civilized stage, as at least Westerners like to think of themselves, mm-hmm. in that period, and the Martians are ahead of us, well, they've probably progressed to something even better than where we are today. And the idea that they were peacefully sharing this precious resource, the water, suggested that they are, or that they were more peaceful than we are. But then again, there was just also the idea that since they're more evolved than we are, they must be better than we are as well. But then there's a separate question, which is, what do they look like?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a great source of speculation. Percival Lowell pretty much never speculated. He said, we don't know what they look like. They could be anything. All he knew was that they existed and that they were intelligent and they were building canals. But others made, you know, were willing to speculate on what the Martians look like. And it's no surprise that a lot of the physical traits of the Martians as they were depicted back then are quite similar to the way aliens more broadly are depicted today. I don't think that's an accident.
What do you mean?
So, you know, well, so that I think, you know, the aliens that we see in our science fiction today, people always report these, you know, hairless beings with big bald heads and giant eyes, and they're tall and skinny. I think that what we're seeing in our popular culture today is Martians. These are the Martians as they were depicted back then that have been passed down through our cultural memory. That's why we see the aliens that way. So why were Martians depicted that way? Well, first of all, as I said, the Martians were thought to be further down some path of evolution than humans. So if we humans, as Darwin told us, evolved from some lower form of hairy apes with small heads, and we now have bigger heads and have lost much of our hair, Martians, who are us in the future, must have really big heads and no hair. Mars is farther from the sun than the Earth is. That means it has less sunlight than Earth does. So the Martians must have really big eyes to capture whatever sunlight is there. Mars has less force of gravity than the Earth does. That would allow an animal to grow taller without all that weight crushing down on its bones and its muscle. So the Martians were thought to be tall and skinny. Sometimes they were depicted with broad chests because they must have large lungs to take in as much air as possible, because it was known that Mars had a much thinner atmosphere than the Earth does.
I had always assumed that people of Earth believed the Martians to be a malevolent civilization with bad intent. And a lot of it's drawn, I assumed, through H.G. Wells' portrayal of Martians. But H.G. Wells, and you have this section about Wells and his ideas, you know, that was he was an outlier. Most people didn't believe the Martians were bad. How does he fit in this story, H.G. Wells?
Yeah, so that was one of the biggest surprises to me. I mean, because the best-known piece of Mars fiction to come out of that era is The War of the Worlds, where the Martians were these hideous monsters that came to Earth to conquer us, to capture us as prey. You know, people probably remember the giant tripods that they used to march across the Earth. But those weren't the Martians. The Martians were inside those machines. And the Martians themselves were like these giant jellyfish. They were just a big sack of brain with these tiny tentacles that they would use to control their equipment. So I assumed that there were people, you know, my goodness, if people really thought there was life on Mars, they'd be petrified that the Martians would come here. That was so, so rarely expressed as a concern. I mean, 99.9% of the discussion of the Martians was we want to contact them, that they could be our saviors. H.G. Wells, in 1898, he came out with his book, The War of the Worlds. 10 years later, in 1908, he revisited what the Martians might be like in a piece for Cosmopolitan magazine. By then, he had met Percival Lowell. Mm-hmm. He had pretty much been convinced by Lowell of Lowell's theory.
Wow.
Now the Martians were not hideous monsters. Yeah. He now depicted them, like many others did, as these sort of humanoid creatures with big eyes. They were skinny. They had antennae. And he added wings, too. He thought, well, given that there are these wide temperature swings on Mars, since it's, you know, it's this dry desert, cold nights, warmer days, maybe they had feathers to help insulate them. And there are these wonderful illustrations, that I have them in my book, that went with that 1908 article of H.G. Wells's. And the Martians look like angels. They've got wings.
Yeah.
And that really is the way people saw them at that time, as our guardian angels, who, if we could just get in touch with them, they could be our saviors.
David Baron. His book is The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the science writer David Barron. We're talking about his new book, The Martians. Can you say a little bit more about what it was like during that Mars craze? You mentioned, for example, in New York, there were these dinner parties, and then there were these plays. And then you had the Yellow Press plays a real role in this. I mean, it really was a cultural obsession, I guess.
Oh, yeah. By the early 1900s, the Martians were everywhere. They were depicted on the Broadway stage and in vaudeville skits. There were songs about them from Tin Pan Alley. Martians were showing up in advertising. Soon there was a Martian in the comics named Mr. Skygak from Mars, who was this roving correspondent sent from the Red Planet to study the ways of people and send reports back home. And invariably, he misunderstood the behaviors of people. So the Martians and there was this famous dinner party. There was this dinner party in, I believe it was 1907. Mamie Fish, this famous socialite in the upper class New York scene, she held a dinner party where a Martian showed up between courses to talk to the guests about Mars. So the Martians, they were showing up everywhere.
At what point, and I'm not sure if it was one particular moment, although I do want to ask you about a particular moment, but when does the craze fade? When does the fever break, I'll put it that way, about this certain idea that Mars is a civilization that has, you know, people digging these massive canals? It seems like there's an astronomer, Eugene Antoniadi, I think is how it's pronounced, that you write about in this moment in 1909. He's in France. He had believed for a time, by the way, Lowell's idea about canals. But he has a moment of clarity. I'm not sure it was the moment that broke everything, but it seemed like an important moment. You want to talk about this?
Right. So I think it's interesting that Lowell was taken down by a former believer.
Yeah.
And I think that that's important because, you know, Lowell had his plenty of doubters among astronomers. He also had supporters, but there were a lot of astronomers who looked at Mars. They didn't see straight lines.
Right.
They didn't know what Lowell was talking about. But Lowell had a very easy comeback. He said, well, you're not studying Mars at the right time. You don't study it enough. You have to study it over months and months and years to really see the canals. Your eye isn't good enough. Your telescope isn't good enough. Your observatory is not placed in such a perfect location like mine is in Flagstaff, Arizona, on a high hill. You know, you've got atmospheric distortion, so you can't see the canals. Hardly anyone studied Mars anywhere near as assiduously as Lowell did.
Yeah.
So it was very easy for him to bat down the others. Well, Eugène Michel Antoniadi in France had studied Mars quite extensively. He worked for a time for Camille Flammarion in Paris, another believer in the canals. And Antoniadi had mapped the canals. He put out these beautiful maps showing these straight lines all across Mars in the 1890s. But then he started to wonder whether he was being tricked. Looking at Mars through an Earth-bound telescope, even a really good one, you have to contend with the Earth's atmosphere. It's like looking up from the bottom of an ocean. The atmospheric waves distort the light waves as they come in. And so looking at Mars through an Earth-bound telescope, it's almost always going to be going in and out of focus and distorting. You have to just study it for very long periods and wait for brief moments when it sits still and it reveals what's there. It's very hard to really get a close look. And Antoniotti was starting to think, well, maybe, you know, if you're looking at something at that's so far away and it's at the very edge of clarity, the eye will naturally look for patterns even if they're not there. And so, you know, what might be just natural speckling on the surface or the boundary between two areas of different shading, the eye might see a straight line, might connect dots in a way to make sense out of something that's disordered. And so Antoniotti was starting to question if the lines that he saw were really there. But he would go back and forth, and he was listening to what Lowell was saying, and Lowell started to take photographs of Mars, tiny, grainy photographs, but he claimed that they proved the existence of the canals, and Antoniotti thought he saw the canals on those Mars pictures. Well, in 1909, Antoniotti was able to use the largest telescope in Europe, right outside Paris. And on one of the nights when Mars was at its very closest approach to Earth, he was blessed with just perfect observing conditions. And when Antoniotti looked through the telescope at what is normally this rippling, fuzzy, round orb in space, and he knew where to look. He knew where the canals were supposed to be. He had mapped them. And now where he had seen the canals, there were no canals. There were no straight lines. There were very naturalistic features of kind of knotted or braided sort of features. You know, might be, who knows what they were, but they were not straight lines. And Antoniotti not only was a very respected astronomer, but he was just a superb sketch artist. And he was able to sketch very clearly what he saw, very convincingly, and shared those drawings with Lowell, who dismissed them, but also with the broader astronomical community. And this was at a time when also some other astronomical observatories were starting to take photographs of Mars that were aligned with what Antoniotti had drawn and not what Lowell was depicting of these straight lines. So that 1909 period and Antoniotti himself, really, that was a very important turning point, certainly for the astronomical community to turn against Lowell and finally dismiss this crazy idea of the Martian civilization as fantasy.
Schiaparelli, even by, I think it's 1910, starts to have his doubts. But this is how you put it in the book. Lowell refused to follow him into the darkness. So did he ever, Lowell, entertain the idea that Mars wasn't inhabited, that the canals were, just as you say, a kind of an amalgam of misperceptions?
Not once, not publicly.
Yeah.
No, the more the skeptics attacked him, the more he dug in his heels. And he always had some response. He always had some explanation for why he was right and they were wrong. But he was increasingly isolated. I mean, he was just, you know, he was having to build this crazy contraption, this Rube Goldberg sort of device to explain how the canals could really exist with all the evidence suggesting that they're not there. But he never gave up. And I mean, to his dying day, he really saw himself as a persecuted genius. And unfortunately, he's going down in history as someone who was a great fool. But again, I went into it thinking he was a great fool, and in some ways he was, but he actually did a lot of good as well.
You mentioned Francis Bacon, the philosopher, who wrote about, you know, what we now sort of think of as confirmation bias. Here's the quote from the use in the book. "The human understanding, when it has once adopted an opinion, draws all thing else to support and agree with it." And then he goes on to talk about how we neglect everything else that might confirm it. And this is what's happening, of course, with Lowell. But you also say, you kind of cut him some slack. You say that that Percival, there was something, it wasn't necessarily a failing, let's put it that way, that you saw something valuable in some way with his conviction. I don't know. Talk about where you came down ultimately about that.
Well, I cut him some slack for really what he was doing up until 1909. You know, he had presented a coherent theory that explained the strange things on Mars.
Yeah.
I think it was worthy of investigation. He spent a lot of money and a lot of time collecting data. You know, he pushed other scientists to come up with their own theories to either, you know, support or refute what he was coming up with. That's all positive. Where I do fault him is, yeah, I mean, he was expressing confirmation bias to the extreme, that he would any evidence that came in, he would find a way to fit it into his theory to be supportive and not to dismiss it. So I think, and if someone is going to devote their career to a subject, whether it's, you know, becoming a cancer specialist or a technologist or an astronomer, you know, you get your pet theory and you want to show that you're right. And that drives you forward. But there has to come a point where you concede, where you realize, okay, this is not about me. This is about finding out what the truth is. And now I acknowledge I was wrong. And that's, you know, being wrong. Most scientific theories are wrong. That's just the way it is. But you need, you know, you need that whole collection of ideas to be brought forward to then figure out which one is right. So I think until 1909, when Antoniotti came along, I was kind of on Lowell's side. After that, to not even acknowledge he might be wrong just showed real hubris. And, you know, but I also feel bad for him. I do think he was dealing with mental health issues. Yeah. It's pretty clear that he was bipolar. He had long periods of deep depression. And I think he would go into these manic periods where he had a real sense of self-aggrandizement. And the fact that he came from money just fed into that. He was used to people kowtowing to him. And it was very hard for him to concede he was wrong. And on top of that, again, being a Lowell, being the firstborn of his family, having been told by his father that it was his role to do something of real meaning in life, to have accepted that he, by that point in 1910, say, he had spent 16 years and a whole lot of money promoting a theory that turned out to be fall apart as just an optical illusion, his mind was not able to accept that.
You end with the idea of hope. And I wanted to, I guess, finally ask you about that. That, you know, we know a lot about Mars these days. We've sent rovers onto its surface. We understand the physics of that space and all of that. But you say that today's Martians are still what they were in Lowell's time in the sense that they were an embodiment of hope. What do you mean?
Well, the big excitement about Mars today, you know, certainly what's talked about the most, is the idea of sending humans there. You know, but the biggest proponent, of course, of the idea of not only going to Mars, but colonizing it, is Elon Musk, who has said the whole reason he's become a multi-billionaire is because he wants to spend his money starting a new civilization on Mars. And the way Musk talks about it is that we will go to Mars and we'll start over and we'll do it better. That we can go there, create a society from scratch, and leave human foibles behind. It's in some ways a kind of an inspiring idea, but is it realistic that we could take people to Mars, which is a planet that will be just a dreadful place to live for a very long time, and not bring our problems with us? I think once again, we're projecting onto Mars what we wish were there, rather than what really is there. That's what happened back in Lowell's time. I think that's what's happening today for a lot of the Mars enthusiasts as well. I'm very much in favor of starting to send people there. I think colonizing Mars is a whole different matter, but I would love to see astronauts there and to start studying the place. And I do think that Elon Musk is absolutely right that in the long term, and by long term, I mean hundreds of millions or billions of years, if humanity or whatever becomes of humanity is going to survive, we can't just all be on one planet. We have to start spreading out. He's absolutely right. Do we have to do it tomorrow? No. If someday we need to do it, we might as well start now. So I'm very much in favor of Mars exploration, but I think we need to do it with our eyes open, that it's going to be really difficult. We're not going to send 1 million people to Mars in the next 50 years. But I'm all for starting and to do it. I find it inspiring. I find it, imagining what we could be there, could do on Mars is great, but we need to keep our eyes open to the realities as well.
David Baron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. It was a fun conversation.
David Baron, his book is called The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.